we've got from the previous one. Something, you know. So the challenge today will be twofold, I guess. So a lot of you are already used to thinking of quantum mechanics as a relational theory. So I guess that my challenge will be to convince you that the information theoretic perspective might offer one new interesting insights on the problem. And for those of you who are more like in the quantum information field, well, I'll try to convince you that this is interesting and try to explain in very, very elementary quantum mechanics, which we're all used to, what your colleagues here are doing on very much more sophisticated models. So, all right, so here's the goal of a relational theory. Well, what you want to do is isolate the chief insight of quantum theory and general relativity, or that's what we'll try to do, and explore those consequences on a very simple model. So I highlighted the simple model because this is the key feature of my talk. Everything's going to be very simple. And then maybe we'll try to generalize it to more complicated model. So I mean, this obviously requires a choice, and I'm going to choose these two assumptions. So I'm going to see quantum mechanics as essentially just a set of tools, and we use these tools to describe physical systems. That's what quantum theory is. So I'll assume all the standard things that you find in quantum mechanical textbooks. Textbook on quantum theory. And general theories, general relativity says that physical description should not depend on an external background. And I will also rely heavily on a Bayesian approach to quantum mechanics. So, I said that this was not in the interpretation, and then I started putting these nasty words. So I don't think that the Bayesian approach is central to what I'll be doing, but it certainly helped justifying some of the mathematical steps of what I'll be doing. So here's what we'll do. To every orthodox physical description, so by orthodox I mean like take your favorite books from which you've learned quantum theory, like Quentinucci, and you apply the four rules. The first one says that you should treat everything quantum mechanically. If you want to do approximation, you can do them if you need, like doing calculation, but everything is quantum mechanically. You should use Hamiltonian with the appropriate symmetries. Rule 3 is the most important one. It says introduce equivalent classes between states related by an element of symmetry. And of course, this is what a lot of people have been doing this for many years now. I guess they call this taking the quotient of a state space by a symmetry group. And essentially, all it means is that if you have a solution for the wave function of the universe and you shift it to the left by 1 meter, it's the same solution. So you should identify these two things because they're related by a symmetry transformation. And last thing is that you'll give the usual interpretation to density operators. There will be a twist on this, but I don't think I'll have time to discuss it a lot. And the idea is that in the appropriate macroscopic limit, this relational description will be equivalent to an orthodox description. But the important point is that when you don't take these limits, you don't take infinities, you get corrections to the prediction. So the orthodox description, what you've learned, is just an approximation to something that is fundamentally relational, if you buy this relation. So, I mean, looking at the four rules I just said, there's nothing really innovative about them. They're pretty simple. But we'll apply them with a lot of zeal and again, on a simple model, and see what we get out of them. And what we'll get is a fully relational theory that we can easily interpret. Everything will be easily motivated, and we'll have an easy interpretation. We'll look at the new physics that comes out of this model. And, well, I'm repeating myself, but the goal here is really to do something simple that is true. At every step, I have a simple motivation for doing what I'm doing, so there's no hand-waving, just saying, well, let's do this because it works. And then we get something that is slightly different from what people have been doing. So maybe this is an interesting insight for more sophisticated theories. All right, so here's the outline. First thing I'll do, so most of the talk will be concerned with a simple model. So I'll give an orthodox description of a simple quantum mechanical system, something that you're all very familiar with. And then I'll gradually apply my four rules, first to the measurement process, then to the dynamics, and then to time. And at the end, I will arrive at something which is fully relational. And then I will discuss some features of this model, for example, the notion of relational time or fundamental decoherence. I'll talk about connection to spin networks and other programs, if I have time. All right, then. Yes?
Just a question on your rules of clarification. Can you usually distinguish between gauge invariances, which are transformations that take you between equivalent states, equivalent groups of the same system,
right,
and symmetries, which are generators that commute with the Hamiltonian that take you between physically distinct systems? So which do you mean when you use the word symmetry?
Wait a second, sorry.
Usually we keep those things quite distinct.
Okay, so you say, for example, Lorentz symmetry, you would say, is of the second type.
In an ordinary Minkowski space background field theory,
right,
then Lorentz invariants are transformations between physically distinct states.
Right. And these, okay, so my point will be that these, you should treat states that are related by one of those symmetries as physically equivalent. So if you have one solution and you boost it and you get another solution, they're the same solution.
So you're not making a distinction between gauge transformation.
Well, I won't have a gauge symmetry in my system. I guess that's the point. So I guess what you're saying is that I'm treating all symmetries like a gauge symmetry.
But if I'm an observer, a particle that has no motion with respect to me, and a particle that's moving at half the speed of light north are physically distinct. They're not identified.
But I guess you have to boost yourself as well. I mean,
yeah. So that's the point. I mean, you boost everything, including the observer. So I guess what I want to say is, you know, like if you have a gauge field, what you'll do is you'll try to, for example, you could try to formulate it in terms of things that are gauge invariant, like loop operators and things like that. What I'm trying to do here is the same thing, but for all symmetries.
I think there's just the terminology confusion. Lee is making a distinction between some symmetries and other symmetries, which is traditional Newtonian gravity among gravity people. I'm not sure if traditional more, you know, minor company than that. But I think you're just treating all symmetries as on the same footing.
As a gauge symmetry.
They're all, and they correspond to what Lee calls gauge symmetries. That's your interpretation.
I think that's
right. And I think from this point we stop the discussion and ask David to
come. That's a good idea. I should also say that I'm starting with an example here. So a lot of things, you know, can be generalized throughout. So I'll try to focus on the example first. At the end, I'm going to try to generalize. Of course, your inputs are very much welcome. Okay, so here's something extremely simple. We have a spin 1/2 particle. We put it in an external magnetic field. And we choose the x direction so that magnetic field is pointing in the x direction. So we have this Hamiltonian, very simple. We suppose that the state is initially in this superposition of up and down state with respect to the z basis. And, you know, you can all solve this system, and this is the solution at time t. So you have these coefficient alpha of t, beta of t. So this is, you know, what I call orthodox quantum mechanics. And then you say, well, I want to measure this system at time tau, so you need a measurement apparatus. And I'll make the simplest model. I mean, I'm sure you all have favorite model of measurement and interpretations and so on, but they essentially boil down to this. So you start your measurement apparatus in this state, which is pointing in the x direction in this example, and you have a coupling Hamiltonian between the system and the measurement apparatus, which, for example, you can choose it this way. This will give a good measurement apparatus, and the coupling constant is, you choose it to be pi over 2, just so that everything works out magically. Right after this measurement, this measurement is of course just an impulse, but what is important is that it's very strong and very short compared to the typical time scale of the system. And immediately after this time, tau, what you get is a state between the system and the apparatus that is correlated. Can I do this? And typically, you say, well, the measurement apparatus is classical, so it cannot be in a quantum superposition. It's got to be in either up or down. So, and this is called a collapse phase. And so you're going to say, well, the joint state will therefore decohere or collapse to this thing here, which is now a statistical mixture of up and down. And, well, you have the desired interpretation that both the measurement apparatus and the system are in the upstate with probability alpha of tau squared, or they're in the downstate with probability beta of tau squared. You say, well, this has completed the measurement process. Of course, this description, the whole thing I just give you, is not background independent for several reasons. First, the magnetic field and the measurement apparatus are treated classically, and they refer to an external coordinate system. So I said that the magnetic field was in the x direction, so this depends on an external coordinate system. The observable, so when I said that the measurement apparatus cannot be in a superposition, well, you should ask, superposition of what? And then I'd answer, well, superposition of sigma z. So this is a preferred observable that I've chosen for no particular reason. And we say that this observable is superselective. And again, this makes reference to an external coordinate system. Of course, the coupling was not rotationally invariant. If you remember, it was something like the sigma x, sigma y coupling. So it was not rotationally invariant, and it depended on time, so it depended on an external coordinate system for time. So essentially, what I'm saying here is that pretty much everything that could go wrong went wrong with this model, so it's a good place to start applying the rules. Okay, so in what follows, what I want to do is get rid of all these problems. So I'll kind of translate this orthodox description into something that is fully relational. And of course, to do this, I'll need to introduce a bunch of systems, for example, to model the measurement apparatus and so on. So it will be a good idea to introduce some standard notation, since I have so many systems. So system will be labeled by calligraphic capital letters, like A. Operator space, filter space, and whatever is referring to this system, I'll put the letter as a superscript. And everything, well, there'll be a lot of spins in this. So the quantum number associated to the total angular momentum of a particle will be labeled by the Sang letter in Roman font. And the quantum number associated to the angular momentum along the z-axis will have the same lowercase letters. So here's an example. Suppose we take particle A, calligraphic letter. It's a spin A particle, so A could be any half integer. So its total angular momentum is given by this thing, just the Casimir operator, A times A plus 1. Its angular momentum along the z-axis will be small a, lowercase a. And these guys live in this Hilbert space, which is a 2a plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space. So is everyone happy with this notation? Because this will come up all the time. Okay?
So is a, the first a in the set is just a formal symbol, and the second a is sort of a name of a variable?
No, the first a is the so you have this, okay, so G,
So when you put system G, it will be like G, B, and you will get for B, have capital B and four.
Yes, so capital A is really saying, like, this is a spin 1/2 particle, or this is a spin 1 particle. And so so this JA squared, it's not as such a good notation. JA squared is JX squared plus JY squared plus JZ squared. That's the matrix. And if you do it like on a spin 1/2, it would spit up 1/2 times 1/2 plus 1. And so this gives you the total. You can think of it as the length of the vector. And the small a is the projection of this vector on the z-axis. So there are two polynomials. We take capital A to be fixed, usually. So let's first focus on a measurement process. So what we need to measure angular momentum is a gyroscope. So what's a gyroscope? It's just an object that's very large and it's spinning. So of course, well, rule one says that this object should be quantum mechanical. So we will choose the gyroscope just to be a spin 1/2 particle with a large spin. And now I'm repeating my... Yeah?
Sorry, let's speed box pretty large.
I said it's been 1/2. Yeah. Okay, just a very large, a particle with a very large spin. And the goal here of this section is to recover the orthodox description. So we will choose the initial state of this gyroscope wisely, and we will choose it to be in one of these SU2 coherent states because they're known for their semi-classical property. So what does this mean? It's not complicated. It's a spin J particle which has maximum projection on the z-axis. So it's like a spin 1/2 in a spin up state, but it's a spin J and a J projection J along the Z angular momentum. So it's really just a big arrow pointing in the Z direction. Now we will define a trace preserving completely positive map, and I will tell you soon why I'm doing this. So it's just an operation that maps density, well, states, quantum states of the combined system and gyroscope to states of the system and gyroscope. And it's defined this way here. So what are all of these funny symbols? Well, SRSG is simply the unitary representation of the rotation group on the pair system and gyroscope. Okay, so it's just these, just rotation matrices. So you're rotating both system and gyroscope. The omega is the invariant Haar measure, so you're integrating uniformly over all rotations. And so what does this map does physically? It takes the gyroscope and the system, and it just averages over all rotation, a joint rotation of the two systems. Okay, so collective rotation of both systems. So it should be obvious, well, it should be pretty clear that if you start with any state and you just average this state over all rotation, what you get is invariant under rotation. Okay? So if I've already averaged over all rotation, if I rotate again, I should get the same state. And of course, this map generalizes straightforwardly to a larger number of systems just by tensoring more representations together. So is it clear what this map does to everyone? So how do I justify this group average? And this is where the Bayesian perspective comes in handy. Well, suppose that I set a reference frame, for example, this room, and I say, okay, within these walls and so on, describe to me the physical system. And you'll give me the state rho, which is described in a certain reference frame, R. And you should really think of this as the state of the system given a reference frame. So this is why I use this funny notation with a bar. Just like P A with a bar B means the probability of A given the value of B. Okay, so you should think of these two things very similarly. So this is the state of the system given a reference frame, just like this is the probability of A given the value of B, whatever A and B, they are just random variable. If I give you a different reference frame, you describe to me the state of the system, and I give you a different reference frame, and I say, what's the state of the system in this reference frame? Of course, it's the same physical system. It just has a different description in this new reference frame. And of course, the relation between the state in this new reference frame is it's related to the state in the old reference frame simply by a rotation that maps one frame to the other. So what if I don't give you a reference frame, right? I don't, for example, because it doesn't exist. This is what, I guess, the general relativity is telling us, that there is no external reference frame. Well, what's the probability of A if I don't give you any information about B? You should just do this here. This was the probability of A when I had knowledge of B, but now if I don't have knowledge of B, I'll just average over all possible values of B. Same thing, so the average that I had on the previous slide was exactly this rule for the quantum case. It was the state of the system given no information about the reference frame, so you just had to average over the reference frame. Yes?
Yeah, so here you decide to average density matrices.
That's right.
You may have decided to average the states in the space.
Well, so
this is a difference.
This is a difference.
The second one is much more stringent.
The second one is strange?
Wait, no, it's much more, it's a bigger constraint. Stringent. It's a bigger constraint.
That's right.
It's a stronger constraint.
So this is like a super selection rule, while the other one would be a projection. That's
so, but why, so why do you take one versus the other?
Well, because here, and I guess that's one of the main differences between what I'm doing and what other people have been doing for a long time, is that here I'm just doing what I would naturally think. So like if you want the 100% honest answer, it's because I was not aware of this thing, and I was, how would I naturally do this? As a quantum information scientist, this is much more natural to me. Then I discovered that all these people were doing it in a different way, and I'm actually wondering why are they doing it in this different way.
What would be the interpretation of the other way, projecting states? When did you take relativity pure?
Rho could be pure, but still it would not be the same thing. because here, it wouldn't be the same thing. Because here you could have statistical mixture of different representation of the location groups. While in the other case, you're selecting one. And that's the difference. But really the reason is because this is what, in terms of quantum information, this is the natural thing to do. I mean, and I think, I hope that I've convinced some people in this room that, you know, with this Bayesian analogy, it's exactly the same thing. It's what probability tells you to do. You can think that there's a reference frame if you want, but at the end of the day, you should be honest and say, well, I don't have information about this reference frame, so I'm gonna do what, you know, Bayesian probability telling you to do.
Yeah, but your second point, as you was that you want, you know, states to be the same under this gauge transformation. So what usually people do, they actually apply these rules. So they
project it on.
Yeah. They take a state that's and then they project it under.
That's right.
The action of the group of symmetry. So yeah. In that sense, you have
But that would give
you
one.
In the sense of Hilbert space. No.
Oh well, I should say first of all. These states, the resulting states that you would get if you would do this, they would be allowed in my description, because of course they are invariant. But this gives you some, I mean, the only motivation I can give you is that this gives you, well, this gives you something different. In my model, in which I understand every step, it will give us something interesting, and it will allow me to recover the usual orthodox result. So I like it. Well, the other one did not work, as far as I know, in my model. So maybe, I'll go on. Oh, can this room is urgent? So now I told you why I'm doing this. Now let me tell you how I do it in practice. And of course this is going to work because I've chosen a very simple group. So these rotations are generated by the total angular momentum operator. So just the sum of these two guys. So this is just the three Pauli matrices for the spin 1/2 particle. And these are the generalized angular momentum for the g-dimensional particles. And these, if you take exponential of these guys, this is how you generate the rotation of both the gyroscope and the system. So it will be useful to express this state. So this is the state of the system in gyroscope, right? System is in this arbitrary state, alpha up plus beta down. And the gyroscope is in this spin coherent state, which is just pointing in the z direction. So we'll express this state in terms of quantum numbers of these operators, because these guys generate the rotation. And you know, this is just elementary angular momentum composition. These guys are like Clapeyard and coefficients, so you can work that out pretty straightforwardly. And now you have these four quantum numbers. So let me tell you what they refer to. This guy refers to this operator. This guy here refers to the, so this is like the total angular momentum of S, the system in gyroscope. This is the total angular momentum of the system in gyroscope along the z-axis. This is just telling us that the part of the system is a spin 1/2 particle, and that the gyroscope is a spin g particle. Okay? So it's just these quantum numbers, and these are a complete set of operators. And of course, as you all know, that these three guys are rotationally invariant because they commute with these operators. But this guy here, so these three are invariant. So the only guy that is not rotationally invariant is this JZ. Of course it's not rotationally invariant, it's got a Z label. So knowing that all the other quantum numbers are associated to rotationally invariant operators, and that this one is not rotationally invariant, you can kind of almost guess what the action of this rotation will do. What it will do is that it will leave all the rotationally invariant quantum number unchanged, and it will randomize all the quantum numbers associated to the non-rotationally invariant quantum number. And this is exactly what happens. Okay, so is everyone clear? This state is exactly the same state as I had here, except that the value of this guy here is now randomized, because I've just average overall rotation, and this guy was associated to an operator that was not rotation invariant. This is just slightly more complicated than saying if you take a spin 1/2 and you rotate it in L direction, well, you get something which is mixed in the maximum state. So at this point, I mean, we can just remove this quantum number from our description. So all I did is I removed these density matrix, because it will always be in a max-minimix state, and it carries no physical information about this system whatsoever. And now, look, this is the state we have. Now we can give an interpretation of this thing, given our rule 4. So we have a spin G particle that combines with a spin 1/2 particle to give a total particle of total spin G plus 1/2, or they combine together to get a particle with spin G minus 1/2. So it's really saying you have two particles, they add up their vector, they are either parallel or anti-parallel. What's the probability of these two things? Well, you see that when the gyroscope reaches a macroscopic size, this guy's scope goes to zero, so your coverage is alpha squared, and this guy here goes to one, so you recover beta squared. Okay, so you've recovered the orthodox predictions when you have a macroscopic gyroscope. And this description is fully relational in the sense that it does not make reference to an external coordinate system or anything like that. It's just relation between the two particles. Yes?
Can you be more precise about what it means to remove a quantum number? I mean, is this a projection operator on the density, the total density matrix? Or
it, no.
What is it more
right.
generally?
Yeah. So, in terms of matrices, If you write the matrices of all quantum numbers, there will always be sectors that are just a bunch of copies. So they are like, So you could write the density matrix with just coefficients, and you could replace these coefficients. You could multiply these coefficients by identity matrices. It just adds extra dimension, and it doesn't do anything. So you just remove these numbers. So it's really it's not like a subspace. It's a trace. You're tracing out a system.
Could you try another thing? Could you try that? You have two systems. Let's say pot and a lid.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what you're saying is that you could put the lid one way on top of the pot or the other way on top of the pot. And either way, what you do is you have this pot and lid system, and you're saying it's the same thing whether I look at it here or there or on this rotation, that rotation, right?
Right.
Basically, you're saying that the solution to your mechanics could be a pot, right? And it's the same pot no matter where it is, how fast it moves, what rotation you look at it, right? And so now you're looking at two systems, combine them, and again you're saying I'm averaging over all rotations and probably translations as well.
I didn't have translation in this example.
But you just if you
for simplicity, absolutely.
Yeah. So you're saying it's the same object, even though you may look at it from different.
Right, so that's the idea of introducing equivalent classes between states, because your different configuration of pot and lid was all made, the difference between them was always with respect to an external coordinate system. Yes, that's the main point. And you want to erase this external coordinate system, so you're forced to introduce equivalent classes.
Well, coming back to your original question, you know, why he's averaging about external symmetries, I think he's just saying that, you know, the car is a car,
I understand the physical idea. I was just maybe it should just go on.
Yes.
Maybe it just helps to say that you're making a conventional choice. If you apply the superselection to the observables, then you use any state in your equivalence class and you get a prediction.
Sorry?
You can use any state in the equivalence, so you set up the equivalence class of states by the superselection. For simplicity, you're using the state from each equivalence class that happens to be invariant. Because then you're less likely to be misled into thinking that some practice
is
irrelevant.
Yeah. So what Rob is saying, I guess, is, and so you can always like fix. I guess that's what some people would say. You can always fix the gauge and look at the physics there. But another thing is just to get rid of the gauge, degree of freedom. That summarizes your idea. So now I had a boring example. There was just particle and a gyroscope, and nothing was happening. I just happened to find the right coefficients in a matrix. Yes.
I think Rob was suggesting that you're fixing it, but you are actually saying you are.
I'm getting rid of it. The
so
gauge should be rid
of it.
No, it's just saying that it's an alternative to this.
Oh, it's an alternative.
So, yeah. I have much more to say about this, but I'm not doing well with that. So now what we'll try to do is have some dynamics in this system. So, of course, if you have just a spin 1/2 particle, there's no non-trivial rotation invariant Hamiltonian. The only one would be the identity. So you need interactions. So remember in my toy model, all I had was a magnetic field pointing in the x direction. So how am I going to model this in a background independent way? I'm just going to take this big magnet. So this is exactly the same notation as I had for the gyroscope, except now it's pointing in the x direction. Instead of having a gyroscope pointing in the x, I have a magnet pointing in the x direction. So it's a spin m particle with maximum projection along the x direction. And you can write this in terms of the z eigenstate, just in this form. You can look it up in textbooks. Now, the scaling, the coupling must be a scalar function of this operator, because this is the only coupling that is rotation invariant. And as I said, I would choose all the Hamiltonians to have the right symmetries. And we'll just choose the Heisenberg coupling. We could have put a square here or any polynomial. But we're just going to choose the simple Heisenberg coupling. So this is a notation that just says we take jx times sigma x plus j y times sigma x, so on. So it's like a scalar product of operators. And of course, you can rewrite this guy in this way here. So now this is the total angular momentum of the combined system and magnet. This is the total angular momentum of the system, total angular momentum of the magnet. Okay, it's just a different way of writing this. So you can solve the Schrodinger's equation. It's not too complicated. What you get is this messy thing here. But look, here we've recovered something nice. So we have the original state in which the magnet was, tensor product, a solution for the system, and the solution is exactly the solution psi of t that we had in the orthodox description. When we choose the size of the magnet B, which was just the strength of the magnetic field, to be related to the size of the magnet, but in this way, okay? But then we have this correction here. But the important thing is that, first of all the coefficients inside the brackets are smaller or equal to 1, and this coefficient in front of the bracket scales as 1 over square root of m, the size of the magnet, okay? You can see there's a square root of m here and m here. So it vanishes as the magnet reaches macroscopic size. So when m becomes very, very large, this thing becomes very small. So essentially your solution to the dynamics is I have a big magnet pointing in the x direction, and that's true all the time. And then I have this system that has the solution that was given to me by Sakurai. But of course, this solution still depends on an external coordinate system, right? This is, the angular momentum in the x direction, and this was expressed in terms of spin up and spin down. So what you need to do to get rid of all these extra coordinate system is, again, you just reintroduce the gyroscope and apply this map here that averages over all rotation. And what you get for your physical state, well, is this a little bit messy thing here. I won't go through all the details. So these are, can anyone even see this, or is it too small? You can see? Okay. So it's hard for me. So what you have here, this is again the total angular momentum of the gyroscope particle and the magnet. This is the total angular momentum of the system and the gyroscope. Now I left out other quantum numbers because they're just constant and it didn't fit in my slide. But of course, the system is still a spin 1/2 particle, the gyroscope is still a spin j particle, and so on. So these are constant. All right, so what is important? I'm just saying here that I've removed these quantum numbers, but they're fixed. What is important is that here we have a binomial distribution, and of course, this is sharply peaked around n equals 0, and it has fluctuation of order 1 square root of m. If you look at this guy, so these states, in this range, showing the range where n is equal to 0, this guy is equal to 1. And if you allow fluctuation of size square root of m, this has fluctuation of that scale as 1 over square root of m. So the meaning of this, so essentially you can think that this term is essentially 1 with very high probability. So the interpretation is that when the magnet reaches macroscopic size, with probability approaching unity, you recover this state here for a randomly chosen n in this range here. And this is exactly the state that we wanted. So it has alpha t and beta of t that were just given by the orthodox description. So now you can trace out so remember what we had. We had a system, we had a gyroscope, we had a magnet. And now we can just get rid of the magnet because we've already solved. And you obtain this state here, which has exactly the desired interpretation. And I was going to tell you a trick of how you can actually do these calculations. They're very simple. But I won't bother. But essentially here, you've recovered the desired result, right? You have a function alpha of t, beta of t, and they give you the property for a particle spin 1/2 and a spin j combining given in an anti-parallel way or a parallel way. So you've recovered the orthodox result. Now, the problem with this description is that there was this t here. And t means that you have an external reference frame for time. So you have to get rid of time if you want to do something that does not depend on the coordinate system. But a wise thing to do before you get rid of time is to build a clock. And what's a clock, really? Well, it's just a big needle rotating on the wall. So the best thing to model a clock is a spin. Pardon?
Too big.
Well, yeah, so this is going to become a problem, that I just have one big needle.
This things that angular momentum very conveniently have the same unit as h bar. So,
yeah, okay.
So running to high angular momentum is kind of suggested already of getting planarity. So could you handle it without rotation, making some other thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I mean, I didn't have H bars in that. I stopped using those for a long time. But I mean, it's all about the couplings between the various things, right? I have Hamiltonians in there, and it's all about and taking the limit goes to infinity. I really don't see how H bar would end. Well, I mean, it would get coefficients, but
so it's really just the number of things between
the guys. It's the size of these guys. Yes, that's the important thing. It would probably be interesting to see how H bar gets in there, but I doubt that it will make any difference. So I want a big needle rotating. So I have a clock, which is just a spin C particle. Again, pointing in the z direction, so I start at noon. And to power this clock, I need a magnet. So I'm going to call this magnet N, because N is already taken. And of course, I'm going to prepare it in an x state, so the clock will be rotating around the x direction. So for those of you who are completely lost, can I have John? So what I have is really just a system, a magnet, I have a clock, and it's magnet. This guy is pointing in the x direction, this guy is pointing in the z direction, this guy is pointing in arbitrary direction, this guy is pointing in x, and I have a big gyroscope here in the middle. Is this clear? These guys are coupled to a Heisenberg coupling. These guys are coupled to a Heisenberg coupling. So this guy should be rotating around the x-axis. This guy should be rotating. And of course, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the state of this guy as a function of the state of this guy, right? Because this is now my clock. Is that clear?
I see a lot of
faces like okay.
I think I understand, but the reason you need the magnet is simply because you have no single particle.
That's right, yeah.
And the gyroscope is coupled?
The gyroscope is not coupled to anything, it's just sitting there. And at the end you measure things like, Cashmere operator for a combined system like plot gyroscope or something. Alright, so now we have this clock, which is coupled to its magnet by Heisenberg coupling. And what is important, I guess, that and it's the only important parameter here will be the relative size of these two magnets. Okay, the bigger this magnet, the faster the clock will rotate. The bigger this magnet, the faster the system will rotate. Now, it will be a wise choice. As Daniel was pointing out, this clock can only keep time for 12 hours. off, because I assume it has just a small needle. So it can only keep time for 12 hours. So you want the typical time scale of your system to be smaller than 12 hours. Otherwise, your clock would go from 0 to 12 and nothing interesting would have happened. So it's just so, just in order to get some results, so that there's something happening while the clock goes from 0 to 12 o'clock, I will assume that this magnet is larger than this one, which just means that the system will do something, you know, from 0 to 12 o'clock. Otherwise, I would get a trivial, no dynamics at all, which would be naturally expected. So how do I eliminate time from my description? Well, I'll do exactly the same thing as I did for a reference frame, right? I'll just define this map here that is just an average overall over the state of the system overall time. So now, in this case, I have a finite, well, my system is periodic because simply because, well, yeah, this guy is rotating and it has an integer period, and this one also has an integer period. So it's a periodic system, so I have a total time, of course.
Well, they need to have commensurable frequencies.
Well, that's right, but it's given by the size of the magnets. That's the only thing entering here. So this can only be commensurable.
Well, the coupling constant.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I could choose not. Yeah, that's right.
Take irrational coupling constant.
Yeah, I could take irrational. Two different coupling constants. Yeah. So again, how do I justify this group average? Well, again, it's just a good old Bayesian, but the Bayesian tells me to do. So I should really think as rho of t given a coordinate system for time, just like, you know, you think of these conditional probabilities. Now, if I give you a different coordinate system for time or a different clock and ask you, what's the physical state of the system in this coordinate system? Well, the two would be related by a transformation, where delta is just time translation relating one coordinate system to another. So again, I mean, it's just a good, simple idea. Well, I have no information about any external coordinate system, so my state of knowledge is I should just average over all coordinate system, and that's going to give me something that is environed by time translation, of course. So now I'm not going to do all the math. How do you solve this thing? Well, you solve the equation of motion for this and for this, and you introduce the gyroscope into the picture, and then you take all these guys and you just apply random rotation to everything. And then you average over all time and you trace out both magnets. And what you get is this extremely messy state. Now, can you see? Things are getting smaller as I introduce more and more systems. But it's not too complicated. Except all these messy coefficients. And you still have, now I've got rid of all the non-interesting degree of freedom, except here, that's the total, the joint state of, that's the total angular momentum of the system gyroscope and clock, and this is the total angular momentum, no sorry, it's the other way around. This is the total angular momentum of the clock and the gyroscope, so I'm first measuring total angular momentum here, and the other quantum number is the total angular momentum of the system clock and gyroscope. So how do I read time on this system? Well, I just measure what's the total angular momentum of these two guys, so the Casimir operator associated to the clock and the gyroscope. I'll get an answer g plus u. So if you remember, these quantum number were like g plus u for u in a certain range, and the interpretation will be directly. The clock needle is pointing at it at an angle, which is the inverse cosine of this thing, right? So I have like, just imagine that you have this gyroscope and a clock, and what you're measuring is the length of this z projection. So given this length, you can figure out what's the angle here, okay? So this is all I'm doing. And you really, once you have this result, you can say it's t to a clock, okay? So time goes from 0 to pi in this case. And given this outcome, I can update the state of the rest doing the projection. So I make a measurement, I get an outcome, I should project the state, renormalize, so on. Just elementary quantum mechanics. Except that in this case, all these things actually commuted, and the density operator was already diagonal, so there's nothing quantum mechanical about this update. It's really just classical Bayesian updating, because all the things commute, everything. So then, of course, condition on this outcome u, I update the state, I measure the other operator, and what I get is the probability for, well, I'll get a random variable s, which appeared here somewhere, well, it was r. But anyway, I'll get this random variable that can take values plus or minus 1/2, and it has the direct interpretation of the spin pointing up or down. Okay, so I can actually plot these quantities. So this first graph here just shows the probability of different different outcomes on the plot. So what you would like is that the properties associated to different angles, theta, between 0 and pi, you would like this to be flat. So you would like it that the property that you read any time is uniform. And this is indeed given that by the dashed line. Remember that what you're actually measuring is u, and u is related to theta by an inverse cosine. And so you have a Jacobian in there. And this is the property distribution associated to a flat distribution of the theta variable. And you see that this is pretty close to what you get, which just means that when you read the plot variable, you get a random result. It can be any time from 0 to 12. And this here, the second plot, is the for a different outcome theta, so a different time, where now time is defined with respect to the plot, this is the probability of the spin-down result, so s equals minus 1/2. The dashed line is just a cosine given by the orthodox prediction. And can you see? Well, there are actually four colored lines on these, and I'm sorry you don't see them very well. But there is one very pale green one that is extremely close to the dashed line. Then there is a red one. Then there is another green one and a blue one. Can you see any of them?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and these correspond to different sizes for the plot. The clock here goes from size 20, 40, 100, I think, and 400, that's right. So what have we done? Well, what we've shown now is that we can apply the force rules to a simple example, and this has forced us to quantize the spatial and temporal reference frame, so we had something, a quantum gyroscope and a quantum clock. We also had to introduce quantum systems just to generate dynamics, so magnets in this case. All physical quantities in this theory were described, were background independent. And what I showed, this last slide, shows that in the appropriate macroscopic limits, you get predictions that are very, very close to those given by the orthodox prediction. Okay. But of course, this was just an approximation. There was always a small difference between the two. And now we will try to explore some of the features of this relation. So I guess this is very much related to what Lana was saying. A consequence of the way I'm doing the time average is that I get this physical constraint. This is different than the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that just says it should annihilate the state. What I get instead is a mixed state solution, and it says that it should commute with the Hamiltonian. So it raises the question that, should the constraint be applied at the level of states, so an operation on the Hilbert space, or at the level of operation? I don't have an answer to this, but certainly a mixed state solution is more natural in a Bayesian approach. Why? Well, just to give you one more reason, if you say, well, the energy of the universe is fixed, well, how can you measure this energy from within the universe? So a mixed state is more natural for a couple of reasons, at least. A consequence of this is that, well, you get a relational time, as I just showed you, with respect to which you recover approximate Schrodinger dynamics. But in my case, this relational time was due to classical correlation, not entanglement. So this is a very sketchy equation. But what I had was just correlation between a clock and a system. Okay. Well, usually what you have is entanglement between the clock and the system. Yes.
Yeah. In the literature about Paige Wooder and Wheeler-DeWitt and so forth, I mean, there is a reason why the constraints were applied to the level of the states rather than more weakly, which is that gauge invariance eliminates degrees of freedom. I mean, the classical gravitational theory, what you're doing classically by constraint is you're eliminating degrees of freedom so that the graviton has 2 degrees of freedom per point rather than 5. And if you apply the constraint more loosely, so that in some sense you're averaging statistically rather than projecting on a pure state, you don't eliminate those extra degrees of freedom. And it was thought that you get the wrong dynamics.
Okay.
So.
I don't understand.
That's again
understand.
A difference.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there's a longer discussion, but this
yeah.
goes back to the difference between symmetries and gauge transformations and why they really have to be treated differently.
Okay. Well, yeah, it'd be interesting in hearing
in
more
fact,
about
so
this. Yeah.
I think we'd be happy to.
Yeah.
I mean, for the system that you're doing, what you're doing seems fine.
Right.
But as a model of what happens in the gravitational system, the distinction is important.
Okay. But yeah, so I guess one thing that puzzles me is that if you do it the other way, well, you don't get the right results. But I'd be interested in
well,
finding out.
I mean, it seems that that's what Lee is saying, that you know, one perception or the other is exactly the difference between symmetry and gauge symmetry.
Oh, all right. Be happy to learn more about that. Okay. Right. So we had something. Well, as you can see from these graphs are not symmetric with respect to the. They're not translational invariant, certainly. With respect to the time coordinate. So all the solutions agree at time theta equals zero, but this deteriorates as theta increases. So there's a fundamental decoherence mechanism due to fluctuation of the clock, which is equivalent to just having fluctuation in your Hamiltonian. And again, Bayesian approach, well, we can have a rough understanding of what's really going on. It's because you have a quantum clock and quantum objects fluctuate. So when you measure time on your quantum clock, the only thing you get is an estimate of time. You don't get exactly the time. So you can estimate the coordinate time given with your clock. And of course, this will create mixed state solution because you can only solve Schrödinger equation. But since you only have an estimate of time, you'll have to average over all the possible time. I won't say much more about this. Well, the other interesting thing that I'll just briefly mention is that, of course, you can describe this all my state in terms of spin networks. And this is not really surprising because that's what they were invented for, in a sense. So let me just go through all the equations and we'll build some diagrams just along the way. So the first thing I did, you know, to solve all this dynamics, that what I had to do is combine, well, you know, I had to write the states in terms of the joint operator of, for example, the magnet and the spin. So this forced me to introduce an extra virtual particle, and I said, let's write the solution in terms of this degree of freedom, which is the total angular momentum of the system and the magnet. Similarly, I did the same thing for the clock and magnet. So we'll just represent this like this here, which is that these three add together to give zero, or that one is the sum of the other. That's what it's saying. Then to read time, I introduced an operator, which was just the joint, just the total angular momentum of the clock, its magnet, and the gyroscope. So this forces me to introduce another quantum number. And I'm just going over, like, what did I did mathematically, and I'm just introducing these diagrams to represent what I did. And of course, then there was I measured a lot of spin, and I introduced a lot of spin operators. And at every step, these spin were sum of other spin operators. And when I represent the sum this way here, so at the end of the day, what I get is a diagram that looks like this here. So this is telling me that this guy is the sum of these two, this guy is the sum of these two, and so on. And then what I did is I performed a group average. And of course, what the group average is going to do in this diagram, it's just that it's going to remove the arrows on each of the vectors. It's actually a little bit more complicated than this. So what you want to do is replace these operators simply by their you know, the eigenvalue associated to the Kashmir operator. So every time you have a spin j, the only information that you want to keep about this is not where it's pointing. You just want to keep its length, because that's the only rotationally invariant quantum number. But not every vector here had a fixed length in some sort. So not all of these guys had a fixed value of the Kashmir operator. So this will force you to introduce a coherent sum of these graphs, coherent superposition of these graphs. And of course, the amplitude of each of these graphs will be given by Clutch-Gordan coefficient. And so you get a state that looks something like this here. So this may look a little bit messy. And I've introduced some notation. So this means. So this is a quantum superposition of graphs. So these guys here can really be in coherent superpositions. So this is why you have these guys. And this is a notation that I didn't have anything better. So the big bracket means that you take statistical mixture of these guys. Okay. So these guys are probabilities, and these guys are amplitudes. And the final step was, of course, to perform an energy superselection, which really is just taking a time average. And since we can write the Hamiltonian in terms of this quantum number, well, you just get a delta function. But anyway, I don't want to go much more into details. You can find it in the manuscript that I wrote. But so essentially, what you see is that, these graphs are very well known and well studied. They're spin networks. They correspond, and what we show here is that they correspond to a basis state for the relational theory. So all the relational degree of freedom in this toy model can be expressed in terms of spin network, and I can write my solution in terms of spin network. Every time you have an edge with incoming, a vertex with incoming edges, J1, J2, and J3, you have an operator there. Well, in this case, since you only have three numbers per vertex, you just get a Clutch Gordon coefficient, which tells you exactly what you should put in this sum. Of course, and again, this is the distinction that Laurent was saying. Usually in the spin network, you do a sum over history, and this is performed by a spin foam, but you couldn't do that directly in my construction, because I don't do the sum, a coherent sum, I just do a mixture of these guys. I won't say much about this. Okay. So, in summary, if you buy the rules that I wrote, you will believe that quantum theory should fundamentally be relational, and that you can get the orthodox description, the one that you're all used to, in the appropriate semi-classical limit. So you should really see this orthodox description as an approximation to what really happens. Elementary quantum mechanics, what I've used here is really elementary quantum mechanics, but I didn't do any semi-classical approximation. And it has allowed me to recover some interesting results. So the relational time, fundamental decoherence process, which was discussed by, for example, Gambini, and the spin network representation for these systems. What is interesting is that every time we all of these things that we've kind of rediscovered in a very simple model, they were all a little bit different, and the most important one is that the Hamiltonian constraint was applied at the level of density operators rather than state. And as a consequence, of course, relational time was due to classical correlation, not entanglement. And hopefully, doing things on an extremely simple model where you understand what you're doing at every step maybe could offer interesting insight to a more sophisticated model. Thank you.
Hello, Anthony. So, are you suggesting that if I say do a measurement of spin on an electron with a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, are you saying that the statistics of outcome will depend a little bit on how strong the magnetic field is or how big the magnet is?
That's right, yeah, they will depend on how big the magnet is.
And that prediction is a deviation. Is this in principle testable as a deviation from quantum theory?
There's
some ambiguity in quantum theory in how accurate this measurement is if it's a finite magnet.
No, I mean, if you...
Can I just add something? I mean, if you are saying that the statistics depend on the strength of this magnet, in the case where I have two electrons entangled, will the statistics over there also depend a little bit on the strength of this magnet?
Well, that's...
You see the gradient. Well, whatever.
But certainly I haven't... your second question... I haven't really... But certainly it's something that that will be completely neglectable. It scales as 1 over the size of the system. And actually, in this case, it was 1 over the size of the dimension of the Hilbert space of the system. So this deviation will be absolutely tiny. Now, maybe if you're interested, you know, in fundamental limits to measurements, which seems to be fashionable, then maybe this is something you can use.
But you could want to use some tiny microscopic little magnets, like
If you make the magnet small, yeah, I guess. Yeah, but I mean the best example is if you know you measure a spin 1/2 with a spin 1/2. The only thing you can say is whether they're in the singlet space or in the triplet state. That's the only thing you can say.